Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Ramzi Kanaan. He has been involved in attempting to disseminate the good word for well over 3.5 decades now. As a young teenager, he founded AK Press, named after his mother's initials, from his bedroom in Scotland. He is co-founder and publisher with PM Press. You can check out his current efforts at www.pmpress.org. So first, I would like to thank you for your work, and second, I would like to thank you for being on the program.
It's really my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So eventually I want to get to importance of an independent publishers for social change, but let's start by talking about your experience and history in independent publishing.
I think my only experience within publishing has been in independent publishing, in that that's all I've done all of my life, adult and pre-adult. As a 13-year-old in 1979, so I guess your mathematically inclined listeners can figure out my age from that, I discovered both punk rock and politics. For me, the politics side of it was anarchism. And for some reason, which I'm not entirely sure, though I definitely blame my parents, despite never having encountered any anarchists or read any anarchist literature, or certainly that purported explicitly to be anarchist, nevertheless, at the tender age of 13, I not only decided that I was an anarchist, but had a fairly nuanced, fairly sophisticated understanding of what anarchism was and is, at least insofar as I knew I was an anarchist as opposed to, say, a socialist or a communist or a conservative or a fascist, for that matter. I say at the same time, concurrently, and I was drawn for many of the same reasons to punk rock. In terms of publishing, punk rock very much had what is known as the do-it-yourself ethic, which is actually a bit of a misnomer, DIY, since it's not really doing it yourself, but it's more kind of doing it in concert with others. So maybe doing it together might be a more appropriate acronym. But nevertheless, through punk rock, I discovered the joys of what's called fanzines, kind of self-published magazines. And punk rock, like the social movements that perhaps we'll discuss later, not only produced its own music, produced its own concerts, produced its own methods of disseminating those ideas, of publicizing the concerts, and produced its own media in the terms of fanzines, but also had its own ways of getting it out there, I guess. So its own kind of independent underground network doing these and a myriad of other things. So I kind of plunged kind of headfirst into it all. I sang in a punk rock band, and partly as a favor to folks that interviewed us for their fanzines, I said, well, hey, you know, if you send me some of your fanzines with the interview of my band in, and I'll help sell them. And it just kind of grew from there. I think when I was maybe 15, I was at a big squat concert put on by this band called Crass, who people might be familiar with or heard of. You know, they were the kind of grandfathers and godfathers and mothers of what was called kind of anarcho-punk. But anyway, they played a big concert. And in London, I was there. I was kind of selling my wares, peddling them out of a plastic bag. And I came across a bunch of whom to me were kind of really old guys, though, as it transpires, are probably only about 10 years older than I am now. But nevertheless, a bunch of old guys with beards. Nevertheless, despite this apparent facial handicap, they were sitting behind a table. And behind that table, they had a wide array of literature. And even at that tender age, I thought, this is really the way to go. So being the kind of annoying little sponge that I was, and perhaps still am, I kind of went up to them and started pestering them. And it transpired that they were from a radical bookstore in London, in the UK, called Housemans, which still exists today. And I encourage everyone to check it out if you're ever there, in King's Cross in London. And Housemans were not only a radical bookstore, but they were also themselves publishers and distributors of all kinds of fantastic radical independent literature, anarchist, pacifist, all sorts. And so I basically, every spare moment I could, I kind of hung around them and pestered them. And in many ways, they were kind of my mentors. And it just kind of grew from there, really. So I went from distributing fanzines to starting to publish pamphlets and books, distributing other stuff. And it just kind of, kind of grew from there.
And you say it grew from there, and I hate to jump from politics to economics so quickly, but were you able to do this without hemorrhaging your own and anybody else's money you could borrow? Were you actually able to be self-sufficient financially, or how did that work?
No, absolutely. I grew up in Scotland in the early 80s, which was a tough time for everyone. In fact, reminiscent of the times now today, in fact, for those that can remember that far. The early 80s, folks may remember or be aware of, were the kind of golden era of neoliberalism in full force. It was Ronald Reagan over here and Margaret Thatcher over there. If you remember her classic phrase, there is no alternative to the economic policies. What those economic policies meant were, of course, massive unemployment. However, I did benefit from the fact that Britain still had the last vestiges of the welfare state. So for the 10, 11 years that I spent as an adult in the UK, so when I left high school when I was 17, so from that time until I moved to America when I was 28, so during all of which time and before I was, doing AK Press, I never had a job. This wasn't unusual. I say male unemployment in Scotland at the time throughout the 80s was 25%. So I was not alone in the fact that I was unemployed. However, unlike today, I was able to claim various state benefits. So I got benefit for being unemployed. I ended up going to university, again, coming from a low-income family. I got a full grant. They had grants in those days, which were kind of means-tested, depending on your parental income. So I was paid a lot of money, in fact, twice as much as I was paid to be unemployed, to go to university. And then when I came out of university, I also, did various kind of small person's business schemes and whatever kind of young entrepreneur schemes and that kind of nonsense to get more money from the state. So I didn't have any personal money, but I was in effect funded by the state for my nefarious ends. And so I didn't hemorrhage any of my own money. Technically, I hemorrhaged a bunch of money that the state gave me to better myself, which I can honestly say that I think I managed to do that.
Well, and I would rather that state money go toward producing books than producing tanks anyway.
If only that were the case.
So you're starting, you are producing these books, and are you mainly distributing them, or pamphlets and books, are you mainly distributing them at the time through tabling, or do you also have a bookstore presence? How does distribution work? Because I know that so many self-published writers, that is the big problem, is you end up with 600 or 6,000 or however many books sitting in your garage or your parents' garage or your friend's garage with no real way to distribute them. How did you achieve distribution?
Well, I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head in that for me, in one sense, to me, it's a given that if I'm going to produce something, if I'm going to publish a book or be involved in the production of a book or a pamphlet or a CD or a DVD, for that matter, it has to be really excellent, not only in terms of its content, but in terms of its presentation. But I say to me, that's almost a given. That's the kind of starting line. There's no point in producing rubbish. There's far too much rubbish out there in the world without adding to it. So given that what we're producing, we're writing, editing, publishing is already fantastic and needs to be out there. The key and the crux, as you so eloquently put it, is how to get it from under your bed, in my case, or out of the garage. Perhaps for those who are more, more inclined that way, out into the wider world. And to me, that was always the kind of the problem. And that's what I always wrestled with and still am today. Particularly given that these days, on one hand, you know, with modern digital technology, the act of production is becoming easier and easier and easier. Or at least the act of creation. Production is a different matter, and perhaps we'll get to that later. The value of having editors and designers and actually not doing it all yourself. But in terms of the dissemination, so yeah, from day one, I was struggling with how do we get this fantastic work or even this mediocre work, which deserves nevertheless to have some audience, out into the world. And so I kind of employed a kind of anything goes, really, and everything goes. So meaning almost immediately I used all the kind of previously existing channels. And when we come to talk about social movements, which I know we're hopefully going to do a bit later, one of the things that was an outgrowth of the social movements of the 60s, which actually really means in effect the 70s, was that there was somewhat of a network to distribute stuff. Meaning in 1982, so as I was kind of finding my feet in that world, in the UK, there was what was called the Federation of Radical Booksellers. Now the FRB, to be a member of the FRB, you actually had to have a brick and mortar store, a storefront. So for example, they wouldn't let me join the FRB because I was doing it out of my bedroom and didn't have a storefront, which is fair enough. That was just there. Whatever, they were there for bookstores. I was not one. Nevertheless, my point is, it is an outgrowth of the movements, the social movements of the 60s and 70s. By 1982, the UK had 52, I believe, self-identified radical bookstores. Again, these were of a variety of bookstores, like the bookstore I mentioned, Houseman's, which was technically owned by the War Resisters International. So it's kind of officially it's a Quaker pacifist bookstore, but it's actually much more than that. Since most of the people that work there are anarchists. But nevertheless, so it ranges from, you know, radical bookstores to anarchist bookstores to gay bookstores, black bookstores, Irish bookstores. This was the heyday of the peace movement. So you'd have anti-nuclear bookstores, women's bookstores, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of the kind of outgrowth of those social movements of the 60s and 70s. My point being is that there was actually an avenue to disseminate that kind of radical literature. So one of the things I did was I sold to this network of bookstores, the same way that other people would. I used a more, quote, mainstream, though independent book distributor, who would also sell to kind of book wholesalers, libraries, that kind of more mainstream, shall we say, of the book trade. I myself sold to the independent bookstores. But I think what I was very successful in doing, and in fact, in many ways was a pioneer, was that I was very, partly perhaps because of my punk rock sensibilities and knowledge and actions, that I was very successful in selling books to places that weren't traditionally outlets for, certainly in the UK, for radical or any literature for that matter. So in crude terms, I was very successful at selling books to record stores, for example, or comic stores. I was the first person actually in the world that sold, if folks remember the rise and ultimate fall of Tower Records, I was the first person ever to sell books into Tower Records. Actually, in those days, they had a magazine division. So I started selling books to Tower magazines, put them in their bookstores. So, I mean, again, I'm not tooting my own horn, but just as, you know, as I say, trying to find different ways of getting the stuff into people's hands. We also, you know, inspired, as I said, by the early example of these mentors and comrades of mine from Houseman's Bookstore tabling at a punk rock show. So, again, I was very out there in terms of tabling at political events, at meetings, at conferences, at demonstrations, at concerts, at rallies. So pretty much anywhere where I could preferably set up a table, but if not, kind of walk around, you know, kind of hawking my wares. So I say it was a really kind of whatever I can do to make it work. And in that sense, I think was somewhat successful in being able to disseminate such literature. And I think that was much of that was the success of AK Press, and now currently of PM Press, meaning that less than 50% of our books are sold through the regular book channels, meaning sold through the book trade. So 50% of our sales come from our own efforts of various ways and means.
So I would love to ask you how you deal with the fatigue of doing all those shows, but there's other, because that must be incredibly tiring. But there's actually a different direction I want to go now. You can come back to this if you want. Also, at some point, I would like to talk to you about the struggles currently faced by independent publishers. But actually, what I want to do first is talk about or ask you about why should any listeners care about any of this? Why should anybody care that an independent publisher exists, and why should anybody who cares about social justice, for example, care about the existence of independent publishers? Why is that important? Who cares?
I think it's important for a number of reasons. One is I think that a good independent publisher is an in, I'll rephrase that, or let me start back at even first principles. I think probably anyone and yourself listening to this show would agree that ideas matter. More than the ideas themselves matter, ideas are important, and ideas are a crucial part of any social movement, any action. They're what inform us, they're what educate us, they're what inspire us, they entertain us, they keep us going, they cheer us up, they uplift us. So for all and any of those reasons, ideas, words are important.
And why can't we trust all that to MSNBC and Fox and Bertelsmann or HarperCollins or some huge conglomerate?
Because ideally, a good independent publisher will actually be a part in that broadest sense of a social movement, in that the ideas that they are propagating and disseminating and producing, actually, if we think of social movements as a river, shall we say, then ideally a publisher is both a stream kind of, or a tributary contributing to that river in terms of the ideas, but it also takes out and drinks from that river, because of course, publishing, like anything else, certainly like social movements, is not a static thing. Ideas are not static. Ideas are to be engaged with. Ideas change over time. They mutate. They differ. Hopefully, neither you or I are in the same place where we were 30 or 40 years ago. In fact, it'd be terrible if that was the case.
35 years ago, I voted for Ronald Reagan. So yes, I think I have changed a little bit, and I was at an engineering school.
Well, 35 years ago, I wasn't old enough to vote, but also, as I said, as an anarchist. But nevertheless, my ideas have undoubtedly changed, have become, I think, more sophisticated. I think, if anything, I've become more angry. The more I learn and the more I actually understand how the world works, the angrier I've become, certainly. But ideas and their interaction are part of a process. So a good publisher will be, as I say, part of that process. The difference, the second role of a good publisher is, as you discovered from your engineering school and what Ronald Reagan promised you, is that all ideas are not the same and all information is not the same. So the role of a good publisher is actually to help weed out all of the rubbish. I mean, to use very loaded jargon, but I think it's actually accurate, given that there's more and more stuff out there, there's more and more books being published than ever before, there's more and more ideas, there's more and more people talking at you. The role of a good publisher is actually to act as a gatekeeper. It's to weed out all the crap and only present you with the really, really good important stuff. Again, I would like to think that anything I have a hand in publishing deserves an audience. In fact, demands an audience.
So I want to stick with this point for just a second, because back when I was a young struggling writer, before I ever had any books published, I'd written a bunch of stuff which was not getting published, and I read editors saying that part of an editor's job is to be a gatekeeper, and I, at the time, thought that was primarily because I myself was not getting published. I thought that was tremendously elitist, and that we needed to just have this whole flood of, why should they stand there and determine what is and isn't said in society? And honestly, what's changed my mind about that is not myself getting published. What's changed my mind about that has been the internet, with, you know, anybody can write whatever crap they want on a blog, and or oftentimes in books, and it takes me back to R.D. Lang's great opening line to The Politics of Experience: few books today are forgivable. And so can you talk for just a moment more about that whole gatekeeper idea and how that is, argue against the especially young angry person who would then call you a censor and a elitist for saying that, recognizing, of course, that I'm actually in agreement with you. I'm not, this is sort of throwing out a devil's advocate thing.
No, sure. Sure. Well, other than the misnomer of because I choose not to publish something, I'm not censoring. As you pointed out, anyone can have their blog, anyone can have their say. So to be saying that you're censored because someone chooses not to help disseminate that is not a very good grasp of understanding of English, shall we say, or of political terms. But beyond that, I mean, without being too facetious about it, let me phrase it this way. Sorry.
Great.
I think the act of creation is a beautiful, a wonderful thing in all sorts of ways, and I would encourage everyone to create. I do think genuinely that everyone should have a voice. Everyone should have a creative voice. I think people should be free, and not only free, encouraged and enabled and supported to produce, meaning whether that is words, whether it's writing, whether it's their voice, whether it's singing, whether it's poetry, whether it's art, literature, painting, sculpture, modern dance, old-fashioned dance. I think the act of creation is part of what makes us human, and it's part of what enriches our lives and enriches our world, brings us together, etc., etc., etc. However, the act of creation doesn't, and I think, I mean, again, to use these crude terms, and I'm actually not in favor of rights, but insofar as humans have rights, I think the act of creation is part of our birthright. Because we exist, we need and we deserve and should be encouraged and enabled to create. However, the act of creation doesn't by right, so to speak, demand an audience. Just because you're able to create doesn't mean, therefore, that an audience is yours by right. And indeed, there has to be some terms in life in general, since just because I produce some music doesn't mean that everyone has to listen to it. There's two things going on there. One is, as I say, an audience may need to be created for it. Perhaps in the case of more avant-garde, whether it's ideas or art or literature or whatever. And that creation is an interactive process. But secondly, there's more than just the act of creation. I'm presuming you'd be happy to admit that your early writings were not your best. And that the more you practiced your craft, the more that you practiced your craft with others, because writing may be a solitary thing, but it's also an interactive process. It's interacting with your surroundings, your whatever is you're interacting with, but also in terms of the craft itself, you're interacting with your writing groups, with your editors, with your... So again, you know, what's that cliche about musicians? Or being a genius is 1% inspiration and 99% perspiration. So to be good at anything, whether that's a public speaker, whether that's honing one's ideas, whether that's writing a book, whether that's whatever, it's part of a craft, and that craft is a process. And the idea that just because I kind of blurt something out or I create something off the cuff that deserves an immediate audience is kind of ridiculous.
So I interrupted you. I agree with you. And my early stuff was crap. And I interrupted you when you were talking about the relationship between independent publishing and social change. Is there more you wanted to go on about that?
Yes, I do. But let me just finish kind of what I was saying.
So, please.
Part of the role of being a gatekeeper, it's not just keeping people out, but it's also that role of nurturing, of helping. You know, a good editor will turn a great book into a fantastic book. So part of the editorial and production process, again, similarly in terms of a great design or a great cover or a great set of illustrations will help offset and enhance that collection of writing. So similarly, there's the kind of basics, like you want to have a book, you know, be as error-free as possible. You want it to be fact-checked so that, you know, you're not making wild assertions which can be easily disproved. And you want it to be in a style that's readable and accessible. Beyond that, of course, a good editor will say, actually, you know, your argument's a bit weak there. This needs to be tightened up. This entire chapter is completely irrelevant to the point you're making. So I say that it's part of that interactive process. So it's not just gatekeeper, meaning when I use the gatekeeper analogy, that was that the final products, again, to want to use crass commercial terms, the final products that I produce, I think deserve to be out there. But to get to that final product, often there's a very lengthy process that makes that product at that level where it ought to be out there. So that's aside. The other thing, one of the things that you brought up briefly, and then I'll get into the social movements and publishing, was kind of what keeps me going. Why am I still not completely destroyed or demoralized or not exhausted? And sometimes I do feel destroyed, and occasionally I'm demoralized and I'm often exhausted. But nevertheless, what keeps me going, other than the courage of my convictions, in that I'm publishing, I say, I'd like to think as a modest contribution to this kind of river of ideas and social movements. Beyond that, I'm a strong believer of doing things that actually you enjoy. And when you enjoy doing something, it's not such a horrible toil. I mean, it gives me some modicum of pleasure and enjoyment thinking that, you know, I'm making a modest contribution to a better world, or at least turning on some people to some good ideas, or giving them some, you know, tools which they might be able to help themselves to create a better world. So, I mean, it's not entirely selfless, my actions. But secondly, there are certain things that I enjoy. Like, I actually like punk rock, strange that may sound. I also love folk music. So I'm much more likely to table at a folk music or punk rock concert or convention or whatever, because I actually enjoy it. I don't table at, I don't know, you know, jazz concerts, because jazz doesn't float my boat personally. I think it'd be fantastic if people whose boat was floated by jazz were also inclined to, you know, inject some more direct politics into jazz or anything else you can think of. So, you know, partly what I do because I enjoy it. And I always think it's important to encourage people to do what they're able or what they feel comfortable doing, rather than to castigate them for things that they are not able to do or nor comfortable in doing. And I would like to think I apply that to myself as well. So in terms of the connection between kind of independent or radical publishing and social movements, I think they're actually indivisible. So as I kind of alluded earlier, in terms of that there was this kind of both, there was this method of disseminating literature, which I kind of stumbled onto in the early 80s, which actually now no longer exists, but that's a different set of problematics and a different question and whatnot. But the history of publishing, if you want to look at it that way, pretty much rises and falls with social movements. So what I'm saying is that if you look at the history of publishing, at times of great social movements, which is typically also times of great social unrest, there's an explosion of publishing. Now, not all of this, of course, is radical or left or independent publishing. There's equally an explosion of, you know, right-wing corporate publishing as a response. But again, so if you look at the kind of the first great explosion of literature, certainly in the English-speaking world, was in the English Revolution, 1640. People may be, you know, familiar with the Diggers, Gerardwyn Stanley, and the Levellers, and blah, blah, blah. So there was a massive explosion of pamphlets, as they were in those days, and pamphleteering, both on the left and on the right, both kind of pro the kind of radical Republican end, so to speak, since they did kill the king, and equally on the right. Again, if we kind of fast forward, the next great kind of social upheaval, both in the English-speaking world and, of course, on even more so on the continent, was the French Revolution, 1789. Again, there's a massive, massive, insane explosion of literature, both of the right and the left. Perhaps some of the folks that people listening here would be most familiar with would be, of course, the writings of Tom Paine, who, you know, was a pivotal figure, of course, in American independence, even though the American fathers hated him because, of course, he was a rabid atheist and he died penniless in America. But he was a Brit and produced three seminal works, The Rights of Man, Common Sense and The Age of Reason. I think Common Sense sold 100,000 copies alone in the UK in that period, the period, their kind of revolutionary period, kind of from 1789 to whatever, 1810 or so. At that time, 100,000 pamphlets were sold. The UK had an entire population of only 6 million, the vast majority of whom were illiterate. Nevertheless, there was the power of that ferment, of that social upheaval, meant that, you know, Common Sense was this classic example of you know, what radical or independent literature should be. It was both contributing and was also, you know, part, as I say, of that kind of that river, of that flow. It was adding ideas, it was taking out ideas. Again, I can go on down the ages. You know, one of the best-selling anarchist tracts of all time is Peter Kropotkin's An Appeal to the Young, which came out, in, I believe, in 1905, and again sold close to 1 million copies because there was this massive social movement. There was this massive desire that was hungry for that kind of literature. At the same time, in that era, you know, here in America, you had the likes of Emma Goldman, you know, touring America, speaking to sell-out crowds. Now, the Charles H. Kerr Company would also be at Emma Goldman and other speakers of the time, you know, selling their pamphlets and their literature. The Charles H. Kerr Company had a magazine called International Shortlist Review here in America that had a monthly circulation, or subscriber base rather, of 100,000 again. So this was, you know, I say, the temper of the times. This is part of contributing to these radical struggles. And it was actually because of the success of the International Socialist Review and the Charles H. Kerr Company and their kind of contribution to the socialist and labor struggles of the time that the Stamp Act was introduced in 1917, partly because America was gearing up to enter the war, the First World War, this, of course, and the anarchists and socialists and other radicals were agitating against the war. So they made it illegal to talk against the war, so to speak, which is why Emma Goldman was deported. And they also made it illegal to send such materials through the mail, which was the Stamp Act of 1917, which basically was a way of the state destroying all the circulation of radical materials. So, of course, sending stuff through the mail is how you got your subscribers and how you sent your bundles to be distributed, etc. Again, fast forwarding very quickly, just to end this. So I started my example of my own personal of the beneficence of these radical bookstores which existed in the UK. as I said, they were an outgrowth of the 60s, i.e. the 70s. So the 70s, I would posit, were the last great social movements that we had pretty much around the world. Though I won't speak for all the world, of course, but certainly of any duration, they were the last great social movements. And what certainly in the English-speaking world, what those social movements produced was not only gay liberation, women's liberation, black power, the student movement, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, but again, an attendant literature, which both came out of the movement and spoke to those movements. Because the mainstream, by and large, didn't know what to do with such literature, with a few exceptions, those movements had to create their own methods of disseminating that literature. So they created their own publishers. They created their own, there was the flourishing of the underground press. There was the flourishing of underground independent publications. And then the means to distribute them, so independent distributors, and the means, the kind of front end to disseminate them, so these radical bookstores. So not only did we have gay liberation or women's liberation, but we actually then had, for the first time ever in history, gay literature, or even, gasp, shock, horror, women's fiction. Didn't exist before the 60s. Because of this, so it was this kind of organic, symbiotic process of producing the literature as part of these movements, disseminating it and getting it out to the kind of end users. How that was destroyed by the corporations, by the folks you mentioned, Rupert Murdoch, the Bertelsmann's group, and that sort of thing is a kind of a different question and different answer, perhaps.
So, well, that actually does. We have about 10 minutes left, and I want to ask like a combo of three questions here, and then also some. There's more questions later, but the combo question is: earlier you said that there are more books being published today than ever before. Is that true?
Absolutely.
Okay. But at the same time, we hear constantly, and I mean, I hear just from people within publishing, that publishing is – the book publishing is in trouble.
I would say it's heading down the toilet rapidly.
Yeah. So, okay, A, how do we put those two together? B, what are the fundamental differences between – I mean, because it seems to me everything you're saying about publishing is just as true for fascists or for corporate interests, that, you know, the social movement, the neoliberal movement required a literature too.
Absolutely. And think tanks and, you know, the Rand Corporation and the blah, blah. Absolutely.
So what's the difference? I mean, obviously the difference is politics, but is it the same means of distribution? It's just they've got more money?
Pretty much. I mean, I think, you know, when I say the rise and fall, so another corollary, I think, is that publishing rises and falls not just on the back of social movements. And I think it obviously literally does that in the case, as I say, of the – I mean, a recent example, again, which people might be your listeners might be more familiar with, would be, say, Seattle in 1999, the WTO protests. So – the beauty of that and its correlation with literature would be that obviously Seattle didn't come out of nowhere. That, you know, folks were planning for that protest for years. You know, folks involved in the Direct Action Network, various anarchist comrades, etc., were planning for years. So the success of the demonstration came from these kind of social movements and long-term planning and organization, etc., etc. But the success of that struck a popular chord, meaning in terms of the dissemination of ideas. Before the Seattle protests, the successful Seattle protests, no one had ever heard of World Trade or the WTO or the IMF or the World Bank. As a result of those successful protests and that social movement of sorts, there was a real demand and hunger for a knowledge and understanding of what is this. And to its credit, the various independent kind of radical left-wing press has provided that. There was this huge outpouring of literature on analyzing and explaining and critiquing, you know, the IMF, the World Bank, World Trade, neoliberalism, et cetera, et cetera. And that found a, that because that found a ready and willing audience, which could help hence support that. So in terms of that, as I say, that kind of organic symbiotic relationship. The same thing, as you mentioned, goes on the right. The right are undoubtedly better funded. But other than social movements, kind of radical crusading, if you like, literature has always had a subsidy of some sort. The subsidy, in one sense, which I've just described, is the social movement. The subsidy might be the trade union giving money. The subsidy might be the political party. The most obvious would be, of course, the Communist Party funding all kinds of stuff, particularly up and through the 30s. In that sense, it also might be government funded. You know, the Communist Party's publishing efforts across the world, of course, were funded through Moscow, so to speak. So the same dynamics are going on in the left and the right. The trouble is, for us, is that the right is just typically better funded and has better well-financed or better state players involved, so to speak.
Plus, they have the ability to pass the Stamp Act to prohibit anybody from saying anything against them.
They have that too. But those same forces are in progress. I think to answer your initial question, however, the current malaise, shall we say, of publishing is not really much to do with the rise and fall of social movements or the right or the left's kind of injection of capital and ideas into that. Since, you know, obviously the right and capital is actually still doing very well, actually. You know, Wall Street is booming, and presumably the kind of think tanks and the propaganda and the logic which keep that going, you know, are still doing fine. So that it's not that the publishing is that direct correlation with the success of ideas or of social movements. I think the current malaise in publishing. So to go back to your original premise, which is absolutely true, not only are there more, or to add to that rather. So yes, there are more books being published than ever before. I think it was 3 or 4 years ago, America first hit the benchmark of more than 1 million books were published in 1 year. That's an astronomical amount of books. And this is not just, and by this I don't mean self-published books. I don't mean, you know, you're getting your auntie's photo album done on Lulu, print on demand, you know, 10 copies to share with your cousins. I don't mean that. I mean, these are figures that come from, so as I'm sure everyone is aware, most books have an ISBN number. ISBN is just the International Standard Book Number. It's just the way that books are identified and that the barcode relates to the ISBN. Those ISBNs are issued by a private company called Bowker in America. So the data of the number of books published actually comes from Bowker. So this is something that whoever published it went to the trouble and some expense to actually provide it with an ISBN. So I think it was in 2009, there was 300,000 books published in America. In 2010 or maybe 2011, it jumped to over 1 million. So there's an astronomical amount of stuff being published every year. And that is largely due to the rise, as I said, of this kind of digital technology. And it's been easier to self-publish, to do it yourself. It's also partly the technology now of old stuff can be scanned and brought back to life. So some of that is, again, making stuff which was previously long out of print available again. At the same time, though, and which I think poses a bigger problem, is that less and less books are being purchased. And this only has, and I think this has got nothing to do with the kind of rise of the internet as such. That is a whole different set of problems and problematics, I would posit. But what I mean is that, so at the same time as there's more and more books being produced, there are less and less books being purchased. And the totals for books being purchased are totals in all formats combined, meaning total book sales of all hard copy books and all the different ebooks combined are falling. So there's more and more stuff out there and less of it being purchased. At the same time as the wane of social movements, which I think are important, there's a general wane, I think, in terms of adult literacy. People don't read anymore. And I think that's partly due to the internet and those kind of habits of consumption and of that kind of consumer, atomized consumer instant demand society. I want it now. And that kind of leads to the death of kind of longer form reading. But again, I think that's only part of it. I mean, adult literacy is literally falling, or adult illiteracy is rising. You know, the average age of the average reading age of those that are incarcerated is what, fourth grade? So I mean, people are not reading anymore of any nature. Not that they're not reading right wing crap, they're not reading anything anymore. Again, I can remember when I was growing up, pretty much everyone read a newspaper. Hold on. Sorry, Derek, I was being bum rushed by my son there.
Your son is a media star now.
He is. I'm not finished. I'm sorry, Kath.
Sorry. A breakaway here. Okay, boys.
Sorry about that. I'm now being bum rushed by both of my lads. I apologize.
Oh, that's okay.
But the point being that so there are all kinds of factors going on. And I kind of tailed off, and not just because of the future book readers of America just brushed into the room there. So I think that's part of it. I think part of it is just which dials back to what we were saying about the role of being a gatekeeper. If there's so much rubbish out there, how does anyone even discover the good stuff? You're not going to get that by browsing on Amazon.
So, I would like to have you back to talk about the specific, instead of independent publishing, to talk about this question you're addressing right now, which I think is deserving of a whole nother hour. But in the meantime, we have like 1 or 2 minutes left, and you've covered a lot of really important ground on history and a little bit on the present. And can you sort of sum up for me what you would want listeners to this interview to take away, what do you want them to take away from this interview that they understand, and then what would you want for them to do with that information or that analysis?
Well, I would hope that people would concur with the basic premise that ideas are actually important, that ideas matter, that it's key, and I would love the listeners to this radio program to continue, as they obviously are since they're listening to this program, to actually continue to engage with ideas and to take those ideas away with them and put them into practice. It's as simple as that, really.
And once again, to bring it home, what is the role of independent publishers in what would you like for the role of independent publishers to be in their lives, and then how can they support independent publishing?
Well, I think independent publishers are more likely to provide that good stuff. And if there's so much rubbish out there, the independent publishers are more likely to be your not only your guide through the rubbish, but your kind of barometer of what the good stuff is. So I think they would be your natural go-to to actually wade through the crap and get the good stuff. And I think, like anything, if they're not supported, if good independent radical media is not supported, it is going to wither and die, because the odds against it surviving are not good. So it behooves anyone who believes in the usefulness, the utility, and the veracity of good ideas to actually give something back as part of the interaction.
Hi. Hi. So
that's the younger generation's comment as well.
Well, so I would like to thank listeners for listening, and I would like to thank you for being on the program. My guest today has been Ramsey Kanaan. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.